Hello, my name is Sean Delaney and you're welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. The idea of this programme is to bring you quality conversations with Irish and international educators who have interesting ideas around teaching, learning and related matters. The programme has been on air for the last 8 years and you can download podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. On last week's programme, I brought you the first part of my interview with Alf Coles from the University of Bristol. In that conversation, we talked about using video to provide professional development for teachers and about the work of Caleb Gattegno, who had many interesting and challenging views on education. Today, I'm bringing you the second part of my conversation with Alf Coles. Our interview took place on a park bench in the city of Bath, and you can hear the sounds of the birds singing and other park noises in the background as we speak. I started off this part of the interview by noting that Alf Coles had written an article titled Planning for the Unexpected in the Mathematics Classroom, an account of teacher and student change. Based on this article, I asked him how teachers can plan for the unexpected when teaching mathematics.
That was an article following one teacher and one student that I worked with a few years ago. And this was a teacher who had been interested in trying to develop her mathematics teaching. And it was in the context of work that I'd been doing with a charity called 5x5x5 equals creativity. So just to give you a little background, that's a charity that places artists in schools to run projects where some of their strap lines are things like following children's fascinations, and they're very influenced by the Reggio Emilia preschools in Italy. So I've done some work with them over about 10 years where I've been, as it were, a mathematician stroke artist, I don't know. This particular article was work with one teacher where she was teaching in a very inspiring school that it was an infant school, so just had up to year two, where their whole curriculum was, they had this explore curriculum, where they had this whole structure of talk chairs and cross-curricular projects that they did, except in maths, and in fact in literacy as well, or literacy to a small extent. So I think in some sense, all that happened over the year I was working with that teacher was that she realised she could actually use all of those skills she had in the explore curriculum, in the mathematics curriculum. But of course, what that requires is a kind of leap of faith where it's not the case that the children are going to be learning two-digit column addition and I'm going to make sure I've really nailed down, because I'm a little bit nervous about how it works, nailed down how to do it, and I'm just going to get all the students to follow my own method. So it required an opening up, I suppose. And one of the phrases I think that helped was a phrase of becoming a mathematician. So this was a sort of, has been a strap line for all the work I've done in primary school around trying to develop more creative practice, is that we're all in the process of becoming a mathematician. And all the children already have many of the characteristics of being a mathematician, some of which are asking questions, some of which are noticing things, and particularly an emphasis on pattern and the use of pattern. So this teacher would describe, for example, beginning work on multiplication, where she sat all the children in a circle and she just had lots of little toys arranged in arrays, so maybe like 2x4 or 3x6, and just got the children to talk about what they noticed. And some of them had the same number of toys arranged in different sort of rectangles, and inevitably out of their talk, ideas around grouping and multiplication arose. So the sense of the unexpected is that she can't know what the children are going to say, but she's kind of structured this environment in such a way that it's inevitable that some of the... Well, it's back to this becoming a mathematician. If you offer children a sort of structured environment around that, they're going to notice mathematical things. And so she began to see her role as more setting up situations where children could talk and she could then maybe provide labels and then offer activities for the children to go off then and explore and come back and again talk about.
So would she have done some anticipation then in advance of what she expected they might come up with? And was she trying to structure or put a framework around the answers they give to bring them in a more mathematical direction?
Yes, I think she very much would have anticipated, but not predefined. And I think she would have had a goal for the whole week and the first lesson, or you know, it might go differently, and there might be different routes to get there. So I think it would have genuinely been quite open. But it's back to this, it's a phrase that I've recently been has felt quite meaningful to me in terms of trying to articulate a different form of practice of doing mathematics is this idea of a symbolically structured environment. So she's offering, so the example of multiplication is quite a good one. So you're imagining the children sitting around and there are these objects arranged in different groupings. One of the things that she felt was really important was the symbols. When she introduced the symbols, they were introduced to label things the children were already articulating. And her sense was through doing that, the symbols then became meaningful. The children knew what those symbols meant. So I guess that's also the sort of unexpectedness that she would be prepared to wait until that distinction had been articulated by the children before she offered the label.
And would it always start with concrete materials, like you say, the objects being laid out in arrays, or did it always start from something like that?
Not necessarily. She would often, I mean, this was in year two, so frequently.
What age are they?
So that would be around 7 or 8. So frequently it would, that there are these objects called cuisenaire rods. I don't know if they're familiar to you or your readers, listeners rather. So there's wooden blocks with different colours, and they start from a white 1 centimetre cube, and they go up to an orange 10 centimetre oblong. And she used those rods to develop work on fractions. But there was also a chart, just a chart of the number symbols, 1 to 9 along one row, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, up to 90 on the row below, 100, 200, 300. We call it a tens chart. So that's not concrete, but it's again this symbolically structured space. And I mean, I could maybe talk a bit more about how that particular chart is used. That was a symbolic beginning that again was accessible for year two children.
Yeah, I've seen copies of this chart on the internet. So this is where you have, as you say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then 10, 20, 30, 40, and so on. And what's the idea behind it?
The idea really is to try and offer children some sense of how our number system is structured. And so that's particularly important in any English-speaking education system, because our number naming is very opaque, particularly from 11 to 19. And one of the peculiarities of the UK national curriculum, the English national curriculum, sorry, is that there's a lot of emphasis placed on the numbers 1 to 20 before children are meant to go on and look at higher numbers. But if you think about how you say, for example, 17, if you just focus on how you've said that 17. So you're getting children saying the right-hand number before the left-hand number. So it's then not surprising that children look at 32 and say that as 23, for example, because that's actually what they've been taught how to do.
Or write 71 for 17.
Or write 71 for 17. So it's a very kind of very difficult naming system, which is not at all transparent. The work I've been doing with a lot of teachers with this chart is about offering a dual naming for numbers 11 to 99, actually. So if you think about moving from 6 to 60, so if you think linguistically what you've done there, 6, 60, 7, 70, 8, 80, so this is all regular, 9, 90. So if you followed that pattern, you'd go 5, 5T, 4, 40, that's normal, 3, rather than 30, would be 3T, 2, 2T instead of 20, and 1 would go to 1T. Instead of 10. So one of the things we've been doing and successfully is, as well as it's not saying that the normal names aren't important, but the regularized naming, you'd go 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 8, 9, 1T, 1T1, 1T2, 1T3. And if you could imagine this chart, this can be tapped out so that the teacher or a student can be tapping as these things are being said, and the tapping then, the 1T2, you'd tap on the 10 and then the 2, 1T3, And you could keep going. And so some of the work is just literally about being able to say the numbers, being able to count.
And some people might criticise that and say it's a little bit like, you know, letting children call a train a choo-choo and then you have to teach them the word train afterwards. So how would you respond to that? I mean, I can see the logic behind what you're saying, but is it justified by the fact that you will have to ultimately teach them the right names for those numbers?
So I think...
Or the conventional names for
those
numbers.
Yes, the conventional. Yes, right. So I think there is a lot of evidence that children find the idea of place value quite a complex one. So place value meaning the way in which where the digit is in the way you write a number tells you something about its value. So in 132, the 3 isn't a 3, it's a 30. So this is given a lot of emphasis again in the curriculum. It seemed to be something that children really struggle with, and particularly those children who end up under-attaining in mathematics. I think this whole teen numbers and place value provides a real block that then means that they miss out on a lot of what goes on at primary school and somehow are behind and somehow never catch up. If you look at something like the Chinese curriculum, where they have a transparent number naming system, much like the one, this sort of dual naming I'm talking about, place value is hardly there in the curriculum. They don't really, you know, it's not really an issue because there's nothing to it in a sense. So that you know, in the Chinese system, 132 would be said as 100, 310, 2. So it's like the name carries the place value. So I think what we're doing with this naming is we're taking place value away as a problematic issue by naming things so that the value is transparent in the name.
One of the things about this tens chart that you're advocating is that it can also be applied to decimals. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. So that's another power of it, absolutely. So as well as the 1 to 9 and going into the tens and then hundreds and then thousands, it can also go in the other direction. And so you might have tenths, which would be written as 0.1, 0.2, up to 0.9, and then hundredths. So if you imagined, and I don't know if listeners might be able to visualise this, but if you imagine counting and tapping along the chart, and maybe I'm counting up in ones, so I would go tap on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, and then I'd go this 1T, 1T1, 1T2. So now imagine counting up in tenths, starting at 1/10, and I'd tap on the 1/10, 2/10, 3/10, whatever, 1/10, and then I'd go 1 and 1/10, 1 and the gesture is the same. So there's something quite powerful in showing how there's this similarity of structure, that if I'm counting in tenths or counting in ones or counting in tens or counting in hundreds, I'm actually doing exactly the same thing. And it makes that transparent or makes that available to sort of a gestural knowing. And we've found that actually getting the children making the movements on the chart is really important in this. And so the kind of things they end up saying, and it links back to the place value, is time somehow comes into it. So children talk about how long it would take to go from 100 to 200 as a sort of really interesting sort of alternative to, I would say it is a sense of size, that they're not saying how big it is, that it's often talk about how long it would take to get from one to another.
Would you use this instead of the hundreds chart or as well as the 100 chart or the 100 square?
Yes, no, definitely as well. And the dual naming as well, I think, you know, it would go alongside the more conventional naming. But I think another aspect of this is another thing that I think is overemphasized in the English curriculum is the idea that what's essential about number is it's linked to objects. If you think about the idea of counting, there are at least two different ways in which I might count. Children typically will come to school being able to recite the kind of number poem. So they would be able to say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and maybe beyond. And I think children can probably do that before even identifying, you know, it literally is almost like one word at one stage. And I think the assumption in the early years in the England is that that's somehow problematic, that this is not understood or it's not meaningful, and in a sense we've got to really try and emphasize that one is this one object, and so there's a lot of counting of objects as opposed to this sort of more number poem type just counting. And there's some interesting neuroscientific evidence suggesting that if you look at the brain patterns when people are doing these two different kinds of counting objects and just counting for the sake of it, there are different kind of brain patterns, and that the one that's closest to the brain pattern when you're doing more sophisticated kinds of arithmetic, is the one where you're not dealing with objects. So there's a possible, you know, it's still at a very early stage, the neuroscience, but the suggestion there that actually a more sophisticated sense of number is one that's not tied to objects and is just about literally being able to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on. And so I think one of the things that seems to be really important, I've been trying to work on, is trying to get people just working with number for its own sake.
You've also written about the difference between the ordinal numbers and the cardinal numbers. So the cardinal numbers, is this what you're talking about, referring to, you know, one cat, two cats, three cats, four cats, whereas the ordinals is the first, second, third, fourth. And you think that we haven't got the balance quite right there and the amount of time we spend between those two kinds of counting. Can you say a bit about that?
Yes, so that's exactly what I'm referring to here. So the cardinal is about, so the cardinal aspect of the number four is that it's the number given to a group of four objects. So you count this group of four objects, say, right, so there are four there. What characterizes the more ordinal use of number is that the meaning of, say, the number four is that it's after three and before five. And exactly what I was saying earlier, that I think in the curriculum, the cardinal aspect of number is far too overemphasized. And interestingly, if you go back about 50 years, there was real debate about which aspect of number should we be emphasizing in the early years. And there was an important study in the US done in about the 1980s, which suggested an almost entirely cardinal-based use of number, and that's been the predominant perspective since then, to the point where it's hardly even questioned, really. And just recently, there's a small group of people who I've been sort of involved with who have been trying to research and develop a more balanced perspective. It's not saying that the link between number and object is unimportant, but it's saying that children come to school with a lot of knowledge about number order. And actually, we can build on that and build on that in very sophisticated ways. And that tens chart is you know, one tool to do that.
And is that the main advantage, that it is tapping into knowledge the children already have? Or are there other reasons for emphasizing the ordinal character of numbers?
So if I said to you, what's the next number after 172? Just observe what happens in your mind to answer that. So I would suggest that you are not making any use of a sense of the size of that number to answer that. So I would imagine there are various ways you might do it, but probably some sort of linguistic or perhaps visual pattern. But what you're not doing is bringing to mind 172 objects and thinking, what would be the label if I added one more object onto that? I would be almost certain to say that's not what happened to you or any of the listeners. And so there's a sense in which more sophisticated use of number within mathematics is not about object. When you're actually working with numbers, even if it's in the context of a kind of word problem where it's like people getting on a bus, when you're working with the numbers, you abstract, you're going away from the context. And when you're working with the numbers as numbers, it gets in the way to be thinking about them as objects. So I think it raises the possibility that we are doing a great disservice to children who start underachieving in mathematics. Because if you think about what's, and I can only really talk about England here, but if you think about what typically happens, if a child is struggling in mathematics, typically they're offered more and more concrete resources to help them work. And this, it seems to me, could well be just emphasising the very way of thinking about number they've got to move away from if they're going to develop these more sophisticated uses, which is what the high levels of mathematics are about.
One of the areas of interest for you is how children learn number in the early years of schooling. So, I mean, we've talked obviously there about, you know, the size of numbers and things like that, but what are the aspects of learning numbers that teachers need to attend to in the early years?
So I would advocate a much more playful approach to getting familiar with our whole number structure. And so not being worried about only working with numbers that are somehow graspable in the early years, which I think is another orthodoxy, that somehow children have got to work with numbers that they can feel and
so you
touch.
Mean limiting, for say, for example, in Ireland, we limit them to 10 in their first year and then to 20 in their second year,
right,
of schooling. You think that's not such a good idea?
I would say there's absolutely no evidence for why that might be useful. And again, it's interesting. I mean, I have in the fortunate position of having a number of Chinese master students coming over and working with us. And they don't, particularly the break at 20, I don't see any sense for that whatsoever. You've got to learn 1 to 9 first, because those are arbitrary labels. That there's no structure to those. So you just have to pay the price to learn them. But after that, you know, the beauty of number is that there's so little else to learn. You know, if you just think about the naming, if you adopt a sort of regularized naming that we talked about earlier, if you learn 1 to 9, you just need to learn one more sound, which is this T sound, and you can count up to 99. Because then after 1 to 9, it goes 1T, and then you're using all just, you're just saying the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 with this T in, and you can get up to 99. You learn one word, which is 100, and then you can count up to 1,000. And children are fascinated by that. In all the schools I've been in, children are fascinated by big numbers, fascinated by getting a sense of that structure. And I think we really limit that. And it is creative. Children want to explore. We want to be, you know, we limit that creativity, that fascination, by this emphasis on number as object and the small numbers.
You conduct research on creativity in the primary mathematics curriculum. What is your understanding of creativity in primary school maths?
So one of the things I think that is perhaps unhelpful is that mathematics can seem as though it's this right-wrong domain where the teacher is the arbiter of truth and holds all the answers. And when I talk about creativity in primary mathematics, the kind of practices I'm imagining, examples and activities which are very familiar to primary teachers in any other subject, where there might be some stimulus, some sort of beginning where the children are invited to notice something, to say something, and invited to ask questions. And for me, that noticing of a pattern would be at its simplest. You know, that's for me a creative act, that I've seen something and I've noticed some regularity and able to comment on it. And as soon as you notice a pattern, there are inevitable questions that come. So can I continue that pattern? Does it always work? When does it break down? And these are then ideas and questions children can start exploring and developing. And some of the most creative classrooms that I'm privileged to go and see in, there's these moments where the class are all together and looking at something in a quite a structured way, tight way perhaps, and then moments where the children are allowed to follow their own ideas and questions and come back together and share what they found and move on again. I mean, I've said this earlier, it seems to me in the work I've done with primary teachers in England, developing more creative practice, it's often been a case of simply doing what they do in other subjects and applying it to mathematics.
So if you were speaking to a teacher then who says, yeah, like I see that this could be a good thing to do, but I really don't know where to start, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, perhaps I can give one example of something that happened last year. So this was a teacher I was working with, in fact, in a school in Bath. And they'd wanted to develop a week's work on measurement, introducing year two, so year, age 7 and 8 again, introducing those children to measurement. What she decided to do is the children had just been reading the book Aliens Underpants. So the children came in on a Monday morning and she took them out into the playground and there was this enormous pair of underpants in the school playgrounds. And so the children were immediately kind of hooked into this context of what on earth is going on here. And then this teacher introduced the idea that actually there exists this thing called the alien underpant directory and all aliens in the universe have a unique underpant size. And can we find out, therefore the challenge for the class is, can we find out which alien these pants belong to? So they came back in and she had some smaller ones for them to work with. And the initial task, there were a lot of resources out for the children. The initial task was for the children to just try and measure them in any way they could. As she described, this was entirely her planning, as she described this planning, it was, she talked about, I'm very used in working in literacy to having I'll take a whole lesson to set up a provocation, to set up, you know, and I never do that in mathematics. So one thing I would say to teachers is, well, it's fine to take a lesson, to set up a context, a provocation. And what this thing did is it provoked a need to measure. The children sort of got that these were different sizes. In the classroom, they then all initially tried out their own. You know, so some children were measuring in sheep or some were measuring in books. And that again very skillfully provoked a need for some kind of common measurement. So at the end of that first lesson, not only had the idea of a measure been introduced, but the sense that we need a standard measurement. And so following that, the teacher then introduced rulers and centimetres. So I suppose to try and generalise from that example, I do think the word need is important. And allowing children times where there's choice of representation. So what seemed to be important is that having sort of gone into the playground and seen these big pants, there was then an opportunity, and she had lots of resources out in the classroom for the children to try out their own measurement and trying different forms of representation before then being offered the more standard one. I don't want to be interpreted as saying this is all about children discovering everything, because the teacher very much introduced, you know, centimetres, introduced measure in a fairly standard way and got children to sort of practice that. But somehow that was answering a need that the children had, which she'd set up.
And just as at a practical level, it was the waist size that they were measuring, or was it, because you'd be into ideas of area,
right,
very
yes,
quickly.
No, absolutely. And that was another thing that was discussed. In fact, it was the waist size that they were looking at, but there were all sorts of different things being measured by the children, of course. Yes. And, you know, and you can imagine at the end of the week, then she got one of her teaching assistants to come in with this enormous pair of underpants, you know. And they'd,
We're coming near the end, Alf, so I just have a few general questions, beginning with, who or what inspires you?
Teachers inspire me. I'm consistently inspired by the care that the teachers that I work with bring to their classroom, but by just the sheer hard work that goes into the preparation of teaching every single day, all across the country, and I'm sure all across the world. I find that incredibly inspiring. And of course, the children inspire me. Just their sensitivity, their creativity, their insight, if they are allowed opportunity to express those things, it is again a continual source of sort of wonder and inspiration for me.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
In terms of a blog, there's a very interesting primary educator called Simon Gregg. I would definitely recommend his blog. That would be another way into Caleb Gattegno's writing. So he's been working with the Cuisenaires, really thinking about what Caleb Gattegno's writing might mean for him. Gattegno, of course, I do find extraordinary. More broadly, a very strong influence on me has been the work of a man called Gregory Bateson, who was an anthropologist who wrote in the 70s. Again, his writing is not easy, but he's someone I find I continue to go back to.
If you could make one change to your current school and resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
So school as in School of Education?
School of Education,
yeah. University one. Yeah, I think I would want to give the teacher educators just a little bit more time to actually be able to get involved in researching. Because I think for myself personally, giving myself the space to reflect on what I'm doing and read around what I'm doing is so valuable. And I think it's part of what is important about universities. You know, we've come through a phase, which I think is probably ending, where the government seemed like they were trying to move teacher education very much into schools. There was almost a time where it felt like universities, the image was universities wouldn't be involved at all, and I think that's kind of gone away. But if I think about what do universities stand for, what might a university offer apart from a school, and it is that criticality and that reflection, but that does need time, and I do think university staff are overworked.
And finally, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
So I had two very inspiring teachers. I had a very inspiring English teacher and a very inspiring mathematics teacher. And I guess I always thought it must have been my maths teacher, because I went into maths teaching, who'd sort of inspired me most. And he was definitely someone who I think about. When I saw a video recording of myself teaching in my teacher training year, I suddenly realized that I was being my English teacher. And he was an extraordinary man, actually. And my memory of doing A-level English was we spent the whole of the first year just in discussion and just discussing. And so I suppose a lot of what seems to be important about setting up spaces in the mathematics classroom where children can talk, I suspect have been heavily influenced by just how powerful that was for me, about just this space where really we would have these texts and we were just talking for a whole year.
Alf Coles there, showing how one teacher's influence can pass on from one generation to the next, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. If you'd like to listen back to this programme or any of over 300 previous Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com and click on the Podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good bookshops and online bookstores. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.